Hello, I'm Rupert Sheldrake. I'm here with Mark Vernon. Hello, Mark.
Hi there, Rupert.
We're meeting together for another of our dialogues in which we talk about themes we're interested in, and we hope other people will be interested in too. And we hope that these discussions will help nucleate or stimulate discussions among groups of friends and thoughts in your own mind. And I'd like to start today's discussion by bringing up the theme of pseudoscience. Pseudoscience has become a kind of term of abuse. It's often used to dismiss things that people don't agree with. It's a favorite term of the so-called skeptics, who dismiss everything they don't agree with as pseudoscience. It's a kind of defense for dogmatism in that sense. But on the other hand, you know, pseudoscience is a real thing. So, you know, sometimes they have a point. So I wanted to tease out some of these aspects. I suppose the reason pseudoscience happens at all is because science has such immense prestige that people feel by calling something scientific, it will get more prestige and be taken more seriously. And I think there are genuine cases of pseudoscience, genuine pseudoscience, as it were. One of them, for example, that came to my attention a few years ago was that somebody was selling amulets online made of copper wire embedded in plastic for quite a high price that were said to protect people against harmful morphic resonance and attract helpful morphic resonance to them. Well, morphic resonance is a principle of memory in nature which works on the basis of similarity, and this is complete nonsense. I mean, it had absolutely nothing to do with morphic resonance and was just preying on people's credulity. Also, if one goes to psychic fairs, then there are often devices on sale that claim to work on quantum principles to cause quantum healing and things like that, which actually have nothing to do with quantum theory, except insofar as everything in the universe is made up of quantum particles. So in that sense, everything has something to do with quantum theory. But the claims they're making are an attempt to blind people with science, which they don't understand, to claim a prestige for this product that it doesn't deserve. So when so-called skeptics are skeptical about things like that, I think they're doing a useful service. But pseudoscience is often used in a derogatory way to dismiss things that believers in materialism don't agree with. For example, in my own case, the hypothesis of morphic resonance is a scientific hypothesis. It's part of science, it can be tested, yet believers in a kind of scientific fundamentalism or scientism want everything to be certain, like most fundamentalists. If it's not in science textbooks, it's pseudoscience. So any hypothesis about the way things might be, which is the way science grows by exploring new possibilities, is amputated by that attitude. They just say it's pseudoscience, it's not in science textbooks. It's not approved by kind of people who've done sort of A-level science or had some undergraduate degree in science who've learned the standard stuff, and it's not what they think is science, and therefore they amputate everything that's not that kind of science. So I think that the real challenge really is to distinguish between science as a method of inquiry, which is about hypotheses, testing hypotheses, critical evaluation of evidence, and critical discussion, and science as a belief system, which, as we've often discussed, the dominant belief system which has come to dominate the sciences is mechanistic materialism. Mechanistic materialism, which says there's no reality but matter, the universe is made of unconscious, purposeless matter, our minds are nothing but our brains. That, for many people, is taken to be science itself. Professor Richard Dawkins was professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford, not the professor of zoology. And his understanding of science equated science with materialism and materialism with atheism. And a lot of Dawkinsites follow that lead, and they equate that with science. Now, if you do that, then anything that isn't mechanistic materialism is pseudoscience. But I think, in fact, the awful truth is that mechanistic materialism is itself pseudoscience. It borrows the authority of science to support a worldview or a belief system, which is not scientific. It's a philosophical belief system. It's taken on faith by most of its followers on the authority of people like Dawkins. It isn't science. It pretends to be science. And that's what creates so much confusion, because pseudoscience is not just about trinkets and amulets on sale at psychic fairs. It actually lies at the heart of what a lot of people think real science is.
Yeah, I mean, it's very fascinating, all that. But certainly, to sort of pick up where you began and then and look at some of the things you were saying there, I mean, I think pseudoscience is massive at the moment, not least precipitated by the COVID crisis. I sometimes think that the reaching for some kind of antidote or solution is as much a kind of fear response as anything else. And it's to do with the associations between science and safety. And again, when politicians stand up and say, we're just following the science. And for me, that is pseudoscience too, because the science can't tell you what to do. It can present probabilities. It can try and discern what's known and what's not known. It can kind of, as it were, lay out the landscape. But what step you actually take is always a different question entirely, and will have all sorts of other factors that must bear upon it. I think that, as you're saying, the pseudoscience comes as much from the way science is used, Dawkins, but also I think by a lot of politicians now as well, as they try and seem like they know what they're saying and try and steady the boat and offer people a sense of control and safety in a world that often isn't very safe and is a bit out of control. But also just to add that the pseudoscience in the kind of new age world is always something to be on the watch for. An analogy to your copper wire in a bit of plastic drawing the right morphic resonance would be something I heard about recently to do with 5G, actually, the 5G scares. How you can buy, apparently, silicon chips embedded in plastic that ward off bad Wi-Fi or ward off bad electromagnetic radiation. And this is completely confused, I think, about what energy is, how it works. So again, is just sort of peddling nonsense, really, even if it's peddled with a lot of sort of genuine concern and so on. So discernment for me is a key issue. And so that kind of mirrors what you're saying about being very clear what science is and it isn't, because only then can you respond to all these things properly. But another factor I bring in as well is what I feel is spiritual. I call it, well, it's not just me, people call it spiritual materialism. But in this, particularly in relation to pseudoscience, I think what it's doing is it's kind of collapsing reality onto broadly the plane that's being defined by the natural sciences, but forgetting that often that's just one aspect of reality that you need to consider in order to have a fuller grasp on things. The word energy comes to mind here because it's one that's used in all sorts of contexts, and both the physics lab, the psychology clinic, as well as the spiritual weekend. Trying to keep some sense of how that one word may refer to very, very different things. You know, in the physics labs, it means something that actually does work. It pushes stuff around. In psychology, it's a sort of inner movement. In the spiritual workshop, it might be a kind of inflow. It might be an inflow of intelligence or wisdom as much as anything else. So to be really clear about what you're talking about, I think it's very, very important. Just one other area that occurred as you were talking there, Rupert. My mind actually went to astrology. And part of the reason for that is that I'm working very much on Dante's Divine Comedy at the moment, as you know. And in particular, I've got to The Paradise, the last of the three books. And the first sort of two-thirds of The Paradise are shaped by Dante moving through the planetary spheres, you know, through the Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun, then Mars, Jupiter and Saturn. And I was quite nervous when I thought I've got to get to this as to know what sense to make of it. Because a more mechanistic astrology, as I feel is more common now, just doesn't make sense to me. And I think is a kind of pseudoscience. It collapses the precision of modern astronomy and somehow feels that that can be converted into a kind of predictive astrology that similarly has a kind of precision. You know, so people will say, oh, you're just, you know, a Gemini or something, as if that is the defining characteristic of you, and much as they might say iron is an element. But what I've realized actually with grappling with Dante is that what he thought was that when you participate, as it were, in the pleasure, say, of looking at one of the planets, what that also kind of brings down is a quality that in some way both you and the planet share in. So again, it's got this kind of third point of reference. So for example, you know, when he enters the sphere of Mars, this brings to mind various kinds of aggression and conflict, which actually are more to do with himself. You know, how can he kind of oppose himself in order to see more, rather than go out to battle with his perceived enemies? It's a kind of internal fight. The reason why he's in the sphere of Mars is not, as it were, because Mars is in the ascendancy in his astrological chart. It's because his mental, the qualities of his mental state can be called Martian at that time. That, as it were, is the stage of his development that he's reached. And so he feels himself to be in contact with that aspect of reality, which is both without as well as within. So for me, that feels very, very different from this kind of, you know, measure your chart and predict what's going to happen. It actually kills the symbols, I think, by this kind of flattening of everything onto the one material or pseudo-material plane. And just a final thought, I do actually wonder whether this is a problem of modern religion in another way. Because I think one of the things that happened, certainly in the West at the Reformation, is that because people fell out of love with wider authorities and also became suspicious of, say, higher dimensions of reality, it's when the word superstition starts first to be used. And, you know, for sometimes very good reason, people got very suspicious of the authority of the church. What that meant was that the seat of authority, if you like, became the individual. And the way that the individual could tell something was true was because they felt it was self-authenticating. They kind of felt it in their own life or experience. And what that did was it kind of created closed systems of reference. And I know actually that the early scientists, when they were trying to work out what might give science its own validity, was this self-referential process, and so gave birth to what now is known as the scientific method, where, you know, replicability and so on were key elements. And there's something in that, and because it helps to tease out and to discern when it's maybe, you know, a byproduct of something else that's going on, and not looking at the subject, the matter, under the microscope, as it were, directly. It's got value. But I think it's also really important to remember that it's not, you know, sometimes people say, what is art? And they say, it's whatever an artist makes. Well, in some ways, I think sometimes when people say, what is science? They say it's whatever a scientist does in their science journals. And that is a closing in on the discipline, which, as I say, you know, has some benefits because it creates a kind of inner competition that makes people work harder to produce results. But it's dangerous because, as you say, when a Dawkins stands up and says, I'm a scientist, I know what science is, many people are very inclined to follow that. And then when you're working at the edges of what people define as science, you have to work most of your time just to get it accepted that you're even doing science. let alone have what you might be discerning taken more seriously. Yeah, so that's quite sort of a number of thoughts in response to what you were saying as well.
Yes, well, yes, several points here. One is, I think, that what scientists did at the beginning of the scientific endeavor in the 17th century was to create an alternative system of authority. Francis Bacon foresaw this in his prophetic book, New Atlantis, where he had this idea of setting up scientific societies where they'd be like a new priesthood. And in fact, he described the members of these scientific societies, Salomon's House, he called it, a college, rather like a college of cardinals. And the members of it were the scientists who did experiments to further the power and of humanity over nature. They wore long robes. They went around in chariots. The public saluted and greeted them as they passed. They were his vision of a new priesthood and as a kind of established church. And the Royal Society, which was founded in 1660, was the direct product of this vision. And the Royal Society was the first academy of sciences in the world, and now most countries have their own. And what they are is like the Synod of Bishops or the College of Cardinals, who create this air of scientific authority. And they're all under state patronage. There's no separation of science and state. And this creates a system of authority within science, which has become stronger and stronger as science has become more professionalized and gets more and more money. I mean, there's billions and billions of pounds spent on scientific research now, and decisions made as to who gets the money are very important. They shape careers, they shape entire fields of science, and who gets to publish in the most prestigious peer-reviewed journals and that kind of thing. So we do have a whole system of authority, which, as Thomas Kuhn pointed out, is based at any given time on a paradigm, a shared model of reality, which can become extremely dictatorial and marginalize any inquiries that don't fit within that worldview. As you say, people on the fringes of that who are challenging a paradigm have a very hard time, as I know from personal experience. Mechanistic materialism is still the dominant paradigm. So I think there's this alternative priesthood and structure of authority based on its own self-referential terms. As you say, replication is one of them and peer review is another. Peer review reinforces the authority. Replication is meant to ensure the quality of the research. But as we now know, thanks to the replication crisis that burst a few years ago, most scientific papers aren't replicable. The reproducibility crisis was a huge shock for the scientific community, and it still is. So that's one set of issues to do with authority and what defines science from this kind of authority and authoritarian point of view. Another issue you raised, I think, is particularly interesting, the one of astrology, because here we've got something where, many people would dismiss, many scientists dismiss astrology as a pseudoscience. And I myself think that it's far too mechanistic. I mean, I'm very questioning of astrology for exactly the reasons you are, that it's actually done in imitation of science on people's Mac astrology programs or computer programs, based as if it's an exact science. Well, it's flawed in several ways. One is that the actual, owing to the precession of the equinoxes, astrologers have got it all out by several degrees compared with the way the real heavens are. Secondly, I think the biggest deficiency of astrology from my point of view is that most astrologers don't actually look at the sky and the stars and the planets. And they actually don't really know the sky very well. So it's not based on a direct contact with the stars and the planets. I mean, for me, what makes sense is the underlying idea of astrology does make sense to me. It says that the entire solar system is an organism. Now, for Dante, the Earth was at the center. We now see the sun is at the center of the solar system. But it's an organism. The movements of the planets in relation to each other affect the whole quality of being of the entire organism of which the earth is part, and we're within that. The sun itself is influenced by tidal pulls from all the planets as they move around. So the sun is sensing the whole activity of the organism of the solar system. And that may well provide different qualities of time. Different things might happen. When the planets and the sun are in different mutual arrangements, and with moons as well as part of this system. That makes complete sense to me. How big these effects would be, how much they would shape things on Earth is another question. And for me, that's a purely empirical question. Can we actually detect regularities or not? Well, what this does is highlights the problem we have in modern science, that the astronomers have precise measurements but see no meaning in any of this except confirming their ideas about laws of nature. But they don't think there's any meaning in the cosmos or any relevance to us, except in so the obvious things like sunlight and space weather can affect communication systems and so on. The astrologers see meaning, but they don't actually contact with the phenomena by looking at the sky and paying attention to what's happening there in the way that astronomers do. And of course, in the past, these were not separate. People like Kepler were astrologers and astronomers. They both observed and saw meaning. And now we've had this tremendous split where meaning has gone into the realm of psychotherapy, archetypal psychology, the arts, and so forth. And science has got the sort of facts. I think we both of us probably agree that what we need is a coming together of this, a healing of this split in some way. So astrology, in a sense, would be a test case. And right now, it's in a very uncomfortable position.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I think that the business of not looking at the skies, in fact, I've heard physicists say that they regret that loss as well, in fact, because, you know, I did this physics degree and I do keep in touch with my physics tutor. And I remember saying to him, you know, when was the last time you looked down a telescope? And it actually had been years and years, because what he does now is he just books time on one of the telescopes of the world and waits a month for the results to come in. And he actually suggested that one of the problems that physics might be facing is that there isn't the business of actually looking and, you might say, participating in what you're trying to study and understand. It's all that now has been kind of outsourced to computers. And so it generates endless results, but it leaves physics, particularly turning on these kind of epicycles of ever more detailed footnotes without really any great breakthroughs being made. This is called The Trouble with Physics by the physicist Lee Shmolin. It's hugely debated because physicists don't like to think that their science is in trouble. But I do wonder whether quietly a lot of physicists lament that direct sharing in the world around them that inspires the imagination. It gives you a felt sense of things as much as a measured sense of things. I think is about being in contact with the inner vitality of the world and not just its external appearance. That makes me think as well as another really key factor, I think, which is, in the Neoplatonic way of understanding things, the material world is just the most tangible, immediate manifestation of the spiritual world. You know, they saw everything as ultimately a kind of outflowing from the one, which increases in diversity and complexity and beauty and interest and so on as it flows out. But nonetheless shares in that one life, and so in a way strives to return to the one in the freedom that it finds in its manifestation. And so, you know, I feel that, again, to turn back to astrology, people need to realize that, Mars, for example, is a symbol, which means that it becomes like a portal or an entry point into a deeper life with which it's imaginatively become associated. When the universe is considered as an organism, which I think is a good move, again, it's careful, you know, we don't want to turn it into like another biological organism that has, as it were, moving parts that can then be kind of tested and measured. I think it's to see that the notion of an organism itself is just the external manifestation of an inner reality, which is about soul and spirit and ultimately connection to the intelligence that's embedded in the world because of the way that it's seen to move and to find new diversity, complexity, new freedoms, and so on. I feel, you know, constantly trying to push back to seeing our lives and the world around us in these multiple dimensions, and that what is most immediate is actually an invitation to see the subtlety of the inner life that's round and about, you know, rather than just sticking with again this sort of flat world.
Yes, I think that the point about the direct looking, the direct contacts are very important. I mean, most astronomers, as you rightly say, don't actually look at the sky. You know, I know several astronomers myself, and they mostly do radio astronomy. And if you ask them, you know, what's that constellation, they don't know. They don't actually look at the sky. The people who do are amateur astronomers, and old-style celestial navigators, sailors who used to navigate, but they now use GPS systems. So there's hardly anyone looking at the sky. And if you study science at school and you learn about the planets and the stars, you learn about spaceships and probes and radio telescopes, but you don't go out at night and actually look at the sky and get to know the stars and the planets, because that's after school hours. So I think, also in biology, if you study biology at school or at university, you're mainly nowadays looking at molecular biology, which means that the first thing you do is kill the animal or plant or microbe that you're studying and grind it up and extract enzymes or DNA and then do polymerase chain reaction or something with the DNA. And it's all in test tubes and labs. Again, most biologists now don't look at plants. I mean, in biology departments, there's very people who actually know the names of plants and animals or fungi are a dwindling minority of mostly older people, because, you know, that's not where the action is in molecular biology. So I think part of it is an educational challenge, you know, to have a science education where people studying biology actually spend time outdoors and observing wild plants and animals, or even living ones in zoos or in botanic gardens, as they used to. That's why universities used to have botanic gardens, and many still do. And if you're studying physics, actually go out at night and you know, observe the stars. So I think a lot could be done through actually direct experience, and perhaps scientific education could include weekend camps in the country where, you know, you're actually immersed in the natural world, as opposed to being indoors all the time in air-conditioned laboratories or libraries, or on screens. I think that would be one step towards reconnecting the scientific understanding with experience, because at the moment it's completely disconnected from personal experience.
Yeah, I mean, I very much like that idea too, because, I mean, to give credit where credit's due in science, one of the things that science, when it's done by scientists and when you speak to scientists, you realise very quickly is that it's very hard work, actually. It takes a long time, and partly that's the bureaucracy of science, as you say, the links between states and scientists and raising money and all that, and what is seen as important and not important. But, you know, showing what's going on and understanding what's going on takes years and years. And I think that one of the problems that pseudoscience has, to go back to the our starting point, is that it often feels too quick and instant. It just kind of like grabs some half-baked idea and presents it to you as if it's a fully rounded theory of everything almost. And so to learn that, well, maybe this is a bit like the sort of the old monastic way, actually, that you must dedicate your life to something and you must work on practices that enable your whole person to become aligned with what you're studying. It's almost like an initiation rite. I mean, I sometimes think the reason why I didn't become a physicist was because when I did a physics degree, I never quite felt I could speak physics at the end of it. I was always sort of just about getting through exams, you know, by repeating what we've been told and so on. But it never felt I became fluent in it. And I think that that's a really important aspect of all this as well. And that it takes years and years to really be able to put on the glasses of your discipline and to see the world through what that then offers. I mean, and you'll know this as someone who has been at it for years and years and years.
Mm.
And just another area, just to bring in a sort of soft science as well, which is one that interests me, which is the domain of psychology. You know, the replication crisis has been particularly hard felt in psychology. And yet at the same time, psychology is often one of those areas where a quick experiment is then plastered all over the newspapers as if it's shown something true about human nature. And again, it's a very live issue because in the time of COVID and more generally in modern governments, I think, the idea that you can nudge people to behave in certain ways is one of the, to my mind, deeply flawed aspects of treating psychology as if it were a pure science. You know, if you do this thing, then you get that effect. And the reason why it's particularly tricky in psychology, I think, is that you're dealing there with a set of human individuals, you know, whether it's one person or a whole society, that are constantly in reaction to what's going on. We are living organisms in that sense. You know, we're not static systems. How you build in the controls on the one hand, but also how you can reduce what is always unfolding on the go, you know, like an organism, to something that can be studied without, well, I mean, that takes you back, you know, that's back to your point, really, that as Coleridge put it, we murder to dissect. You have to, as it were, stop it being a living thing in order to try and understand it very often. That's another real great challenge.
Yes. Well, we're nearing the end of our time, but I think that what springs to my mind as a result of your remarks on psychology is economics. Because there you have something that pretends to be a science and involves lots of mathematics, which makes people think it must be scientific. And yet it starts from assumptions like humans are intrinsically selfish and working in terms of their own self-interest. There are all sorts of assumptions that get built into economics. Even in its own terms, it's not a terribly effective science. It's, you know, who foresaw the financial crash of 2008? That's often asked question. Right now we're in the grip of economic experiments on a global scale. Money printing, trillions of dollars and pounds and euros are pouring from the presses or not even being printed. They're just things on computers. Creating money. In the past, it was believed this would lead to hyperinflation, and now they say, well, it doesn't seem to be, so we can print a bit more. This pretends to be a science, and perhaps it would be better seen as an art. That's a whole other discussion. But I think this, the theme of pseudoscience ramifies out into many areas that actually directly affect our lives, and perhaps we could take up some of these in a future discussion of our own.
Yeah, I mean, the business about how the subject of pseudoscience, it's slippery because it's as much potentially in science as it is elsewhere, which I guess is why it becomes so heated and emotional, actually. Yes. And the policing and the disciplining, which you were mentioning, comes into force.
Absolutely. Well, I think we have to leave it there, unresolved, but with all these ongoing hanging questions.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mark.